Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Taking a look today at the world of insects, Phil Pelletieri back. Phil, a distinguished faculty associate emeritus. He retired as head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab and stops by every couple months to talk with us about what's going on in the world of insects. And it's great to have him back. Phil, thank you so much for joining us.
Nice to be here, Larry.
Sure. If I turn your microphone on, it'll work even better. Thanks a lot for joining us. Before we start talking about wasps and other insects, I wanted you to know about an interesting project to help monarch butterflies. It's the brainchild of Joe Rederer. He's a science teacher at Wisconsin Rapids Area Middle School, and we have him on the phone to tell us about it. Joe, thanks for joining us today. What are you up to?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on. What I'm up to is trying to raise awareness about the importance of milkweed and its connection to monarch butterflies. And the tool we're using comes from right down where you are. The wonderful folks at Field Day Labs have a piece of software called Sifter, and it allows users, my students, your listeners, to take pictures with their mobile device. It locates that picture on literally a Google map and categorizes them, and it generates a map of where milkweed plants are. So the goal here is to try to get as many posts of milkweed pictures or monarch butterfly pictures, lots of options there, to show the range of milkweed around here, but most important, to raise awareness.
How are your students participating in this, Joe?
Well, initially, when I unveiled the project to them in spring, milkweed weren't real high. It was a little bit difficult for them to find the milkweed plants. They're familiar with Sifter because we had done some other projects using it. So over the summer, several of those students have latched onto it and have gone out and helped me find milkweed photos. And the cool part is they start talking about their milkweed. And as soon as they have ownership of a milkweed stand, then we got them. And that's what we want to try to spread farther along.
Well, it sounds like a great project, bringing science into the classroom and then out of the classroom as well.
It's a great extension to what we do in the classroom, and it's a wonderful way to get parents and kids outside walking around with their cell phones looking for something other than Pokemon.
Well, I'm certainly with you on that one. Well, what about our listeners? Can our listeners get involved in this?
Oh, absolutely. That would be awesome. I don't know if you have the link on your Facebook page, but if they were simply to go to sifter.org, they could find the Milkweed Project there, or sifter.org/milkweed, and it's a easy project, easy one to contribute to. You do have to register. It's because it's out of the University of Wisconsin, they don't collect any information on you. It's just a way to maintain a user list. And then it's as simple as taking a picture and going through some very simple steps to post it, and a pin shows up on the map. It couldn't be easier. All credit really has to go to the fantastic people down at Field Lab. You have some amazing people down there.
Yeah, we really do. And I think we've got a link on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show to Sifter. If we don't have it, we'll. Jill says, "Oh yeah, I'll get that up." We'll have it up on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Sifter is spelled, if I'm not mistaken, S-I-F-T-R.
That's correct. It comes from the sifting and winnowing logo down at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. But because it's techie and it's cool to drop the E, it's spelled without an E here.
Okay.
I do want to caution you, if you go to sifter.com, you end up at a photo site, but not this one.
Okay.
So it's sifter.org.
sifter.org. Joe, thanks so much for talking with us about it. We'll make sure it's up on our Facebook page so people know how to link right to it. Thank you again.
Oh, and I appreciate the helping getting the word out.
All right, Joe Reeder, our guest there for a couple of minutes, and science teacher at Wisconsin Rapids Area Middle School. Sounds like one of those really good teachers, Phil.
Right. Warming kids up, butterflies are a great, great creature to pick because everybody has fond thoughts of butterflies. And monarchs, of course, are so easy to identify. And really what it does, turn people on to a much larger issue with the habitat issues and the like associated with it, climate issues. I mean, really, really is fun. And there's a lot of support stuff on the internet, Monarch Watch and whatnot, too, that people can get into and get a better understanding of really what's going on.
What is the current status on our monarchs?
Well, you look at the last 5 years, and we've had historic lows of populations coming out of Mexico. It was not necessarily the best spring for them because of storms and the like. You're never really sure where you're going to be until we get into the overwintering populations coming down to Mexico and seeing quite what that is. But people are, I think, so concerned about how fragile that environment is and some of the climate changes because of logging going on. And then the bigger issue in the United States, of course, with in some of the agricultural practices, changing how milkweed has become really very hard to find in some parts of the upper Midwest. And without milkweed, you don't have the butterflies.
Yeah, there you go. Well, it's really fun to hear about that project. And again, we'll have that posted up on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. And you can, hey, it sounds like a fun project. Get yourself involved in it. I want to talk about wasps for just a minute before we go to our phones. I'm seeing a few monarchs, by the way, right now, but we're also seeing more wasps, it seems.
Yeah, well, just the way, especially the colony wasps build their populations, they start in the spring with a single queen. Now these nests have gotten quite large, and two things happen is what you did not see any activity. Now all of a sudden you see them constantly coming and going in the siding of your house, which tells you something. But the other problem we run into at this time of the year, especially with some of the ground nesting yellow jackets, is they start to get quite desperate for food and they become scavengers. And they're after all kinds of protein and sugar, which makes it very hard to eat or drink outside. And so the human contact goes way up. And depending on the given year, and it's a little early to call. In general, I get nervous on the warmer summers because the colonies develop quicker and this scavenging can start early. So in a terrible year, 1st of August, it's almost impossible to eat or drink outside. In a good year, it might be the middle of September before you really start to have common problems. And then the other thing that is interesting from my perspective is, back in the 70s, we had a European species, the German yellow jacket, which is a ground nester, show up, a very urban creature. And boy, by the 90s, the number of stings that were happening, you talk to the emergency room people and a third of the people walking in had gotten stung. And again, because they're sitting on your cup when you're drinking, those kind of things. One of the interesting things is even though they're still out there, their populations have subsided in the last 10 to 15 years. And it probably is just one of those common problems of something new that gets introduced is the most problematic. And over time, it tends to balance. But bottom line is you got to be careful. When you're eating outside, stay away from trash cans and other containers that have food available most of the time because the yellow jackets get in the habit of coming to those sites. So they'll be ready and waiting for you if you're not careful.
Yeah, I can remember back. It's a long time back now, but drinking into a can of pop, soft drink, and one had gotten inside the can and then got inside my mouth, and it wasn't a very pleasant experience.
And even if you're not allergic, that can be life-threatening because the swelling, from the sting in your throat and whatnot can be very serious. And so, it's time to be careful, and things will not settle down until we get well into October. And as I said, it just kind of keeps ramping up as we go along in the late summer and fall.
What do they contribute to our ecosystem?
Well, they're predators on all kinds of insects, and so it turns out that, the little green worms on your cabbage plant and whatnot, they will feed on. And so there's a good side of it. And, as long as the nests are in places where people are not frequenting, they're really just fine to let go. But the other side, these ground nesters are kind of so hard to see where the nest is, and we have a lot of problems when people are mowing or doing landscaping, and they're not aware, and they move a rock, and then all of a sudden they've disturbed the nest, and that's when they get very aggressive.
Well, we have callers to visit with you. By the way, if you'd like to join in, number to call 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or post on our Facebook page. Maybe you've got an insect photo. We always love to see those. We've had some great ones over time. You can post those on our Facebook page. Our Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show. That's the place to go. Steve in Lake Geneva has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Steve. Thank you for calling.
Yes, hi there. I've got a quick question, and that is, what is the threat status of the viburnum crown borers and leaf beetles in southern and southeast Wisconsin today? Does it make sense to plant the larger diameter native viburnum shrubs, considering the impossible extent of insect predation?
Well, it's two issues. I mean, the viburnum crown borer is a native insect, and there is differences in cultivars. You know, the old American high bush cranberry seem to be very susceptible. I have some Korean spice varieties that, you know, I rarely saw those become infected in the lab. But then you throw the second caveat is that now we have a leaf beetle that is starting to establish in the state that is a pretty voracious feeder, and to the point of even being life-threatening to the plants. And so you got to be a little careful. I will say that the nurseries have gotten somewhat selective in some of the cultivars they sell, trying to stay away from the ones that are more susceptible to the crown borer. And there are some cultivars that have some resistance to the leaf beetle, but that's kind of hard information for people to come up with. I mean, you got to do a lot of digging and stuff, and then sometimes it's not even possible to find the cultivars you're looking for. So I guess with that in mind, especially more for the leaf beetle concerns, I mean, it can be treated quite easily, but it becomes a maintenance issue. Do you want a plant in your landscape that indeed you may have to treat on an annual basis? You're a ways away from that yet. You know, the first leaf beetles were picked up probably about 6 years ago now, and that infestation came in on infested nursery stock. They were destroyed. They disappeared. But now, of course, we've got the population in the Milwaukee area that seems to be well established. So it's going to be kind of a slow movement out of that area. And as I said, people who have had low maintenance shrubs that they never had to worry about are going to start to have issues down the road. And then you bring up that question. If you've got the druthers of putting a new landscape in, that's one plant I think I'd be somewhat cautious about.
All right. There we go. Thanks, Steve.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Maggie in Blue River, it's your turn. Hi, Maggie.
Hi. I have a question about the rusty patch bumblebee, which has declined dramatically in the last 20 years, a native bumblebee. And it, specifically in relation to greenhouses, which house bumblebees for fertilization purposes, and a pathogen called Nosema bombi. I've gotten this information from a wonderful video on YouTube about the rusty patch bumblebee. I think I found the link on the Xerces Society website. I wonder if you know anything about Bomba sempatiens, which apparently is the bee that's used in the greenhouses, and the effect on the rusty patch.
Well, you know, I'm not an expert on this, but what we speculate as part of the problem is, you know, as we got into needing pollination in the greenhouse, bumblebees were a great choice. We did not have any commercial bumblebee production. That was something that was done in Europe. So one of the questions was, could we bring European species in? And if you think about that, that's not a good idea to introduce new species. But what happened is they started to use some of the American species and bring them, you know, rear them and send them over here and go from there. And that's how it's speculated that we have introduced a new disease. And so when you look at the landscape of the different species of bumblebees, we have some species that have not been affected, but there's been a handful that have had incredibly dramatic declines in the last 20 years. And that's what it's speculated. We have brought a new disease into the environment, and that has caused problems. Now, what one hopes for over time is that our native populations will develop some resistance in selection. But boy, you know, it has upset the landscape. And there's a lot of, as I said, concerns, not with just that species, but other species throughout the U.S. that have been in decline. And the major source, we think, is these introduced disease problems.
There we go. Thanks, Maggie, for calling. Appreciate your call. Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at 2 o'clock today, Kathleen Dunn talks with the Bishop of Down and Connor to talk about his international peace work around the world including the conflict between Catholics and Protestants in Northern Ireland. Right now, taking a look at the world of insects with Phil Pelletieri. You can join in at one open line at 1-800-642-1234. If you've got a great photo, post it up on our Facebook page, an insect photo at the Larry Mueller Show. That's the title of the page. James in Wausau has something for us. Hi, James. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. I have a bumblebee identification question.
Okay.
About 6 weeks ago, I went out into the garden in the morning, and around the tassels of the sweet corn, there were several dozen of what looked to me to be baby bumblebees, maybe two-thirds the size of a regular bumblebee, and the abdomens were brilliant yellow with a little bit of black, but not the striping I'm used to seeing. I tried Googling, but I couldn't find anything that seemed to look like this particular insect, so I'm wondering what might have been going on.
Okay. Well, a couple thoughts. I had seen your question on the board, and I've been pondering this for a while. You know, baby bumblebees really are larvae, and so this either has to be a different species of bee. In my first question, do you recollect, were they kind of fuzzy looking or not when you looked at the creatures?
They were less fuzzy than a normal bumblebee, yes.
Okay. Because, you know, one of the characteristic of true bees is they often have a fuzzy appearance because of the way their hairs are branched. And in one of my concerns, I mean, corn is not necessarily, being wind pollinated, a favored pollen source for bees, although, you know, some will forage on it, but generally they don't spend a lot of time. But the other creature that came to mind, and maybe where a little confusion is there are some fly mimics that are very bee-like in appearance. And I'm wondering, that may be why, you know, when you look at the various bees that are people trying to show on some of the sites, that might be the one particular group, what we call hoverflies or cirphids. A number of them are great bee mimics. And the like. And, you know, if you had a close-up view of them when they were resting, you know, true flies have a pair of wings, bees have two pairs of wings, but that's sometimes not so easy to see. But that would be one place I would look, is to see under some of the hoverflies if those indeed look a little bit more like what you saw. The problem on the bee side is that we have about 400 species of solitary bees, and so there's a whole lot of potential options, and as I said, it just didn't ring a bell considering the site and how you describe them, of who it could be. One of my favorite sites when I'm looking for insects is a site called Bug Guide. And what it is a database where people submit pictures, they get identified, and they put it in the database. But you can go through, and it really is amazing the number of insects. I mean, I'm sure they're into the millions plus of images.
God.
And so if you do a search under bees. And the like.
Bug Guide. Okay.
Sometimes it's almost overwhelming the number of pictures you see, but you can go through the various families and see representatives and whatnot to see if you see something that kind of fits that. But as I said, if I was on the Bug Guide site, I'd also look under hoverflies just in case, because that would be the other creature that are bee mimics. There's also some other families, but the hoverflies in particular would be the one I would look for.
Okay. Thank you for the
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And James, if you had a photo close up, please post it up
help.
On our
Whether
Facebook
Whether PJ
page.
Or myself, I think give you a better idea.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Stephen in Mazamani, thank you for calling. Hello.
Good morning, guys. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just have a quick two-parter question about yellow jackets, please.
Okay.
So I used to work on a hops farm that had a dumpster in it. And like he was saying, you know, yellow jackets, it's where they like to hang out. I'm pretty aware of that. I was dumping out a shop vac, and I even had sleeves on, and I got stung by a yellow jacket through the sleeve on my forearm. So the first part is, do they lose their stinger when they sting you? And the second part of my question is, when will this scab go away? Because I got literally 3 weeks and a day ago, I got stung, and every time that it starts to scab and it falls off in the shower, I mean, the wound gets as deep as, like, if you had a blister and you popped it. So it's a very deep, concave wound every time once the scab falls off. So I'm just curious how long it's going to take before this scar goes away. I mean, not scar, this sting mark goes away.
Sure. Well, the first thing, the only bee that has a barbed stinger is the worker honeybee. Even the queen honeybee does not have a barbed stinger. And so what that allows the various bees and wasps to do is sting you multiple times. And often the reaction you have both depends on the species and how much venom they introduce. Now, in not being a physician, but I just what you're telling me, the severity of the reaction, the amount of tissue damage is such, you almost wonder if you had a secondary infection that's kind of causing it to heal slower and causing so much tissue loss. I mean, it's one thing to get, you know, swelling and cellulosis and other complications, but when you start to have lots of tissue breaking down, as I said, that often suggests to me that there might be a little bit more going on. And, you know, if it doesn't get better, it might be worth at least just bouncing it off your family physician just to see if there's any concerns there, as I said, about infections and other complications.
Yeah.
Well, it was about pimple size when it happened. And like I said, scabs fall off in the shower. I'm not picking at it, but... Mm-hmm. Every time it heals, it gets smaller and smaller and smaller. It's just, I'm really surprised that it's been 3 weeks.
Yeah.
So. Well, you know, yellow jackets in particular, in comparison to bees, often have a whole lot more pain, a whole lot more swelling in a longer time. And as I said, I think we just react to the venoms that they leave behind quite a bit more than a honeybee or some of the other stinging insects that we've got.
Mm, there we go. Well, good luck. Thanks a lot for calling, Stephen. Appreciate your call. I want to give Jerry in Johnson Creek a chance to join us. Jerry, hello. Thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you very much for taking my call, Larry. And Phil, thank you very much for devoting your time to this excellent show. This year was the first time that we ever put up a grape jelly feeder, and it was fantastic. I used to hear a song from a bird in the trees, and I could never identify it. And I said to my wife, I wonder if those aren't orioles. We put up this grape jelly feeder. Sure enough, we've had tons of orioles all summer and purple finches in that grape jelly feeder. The orioles, not all of them have left yet. There's still quite a few that come to this feeder. We didn't have any problem with wasps until last week.
Mm-hmm.
I looked all around the house under everything. I cannot find a nest. I tried a shop vac to clean some of them off the grape jelly, but now there's even more.
Yeah.
I was going to buy a wasp trap this morning and hang it near that jelly feeder, or am I just attracting more wasps?
Yeah, wasp traps this late in the game, I don't think you're going to gain on it. And again, you know, their numbers are going up almost exponentially and will continue for at least another month, per se. Finding the nest is tough, although... You know, an old friend here on campus that was in charge of pest control on campus was always very concerned about wasps in our football games because we've got all these people with open containers of pop and the like. And he had some success, and he's a very patient man, but he would put a little tub of Mountain Dew pop out, and they are quite highly fond of Mountain Dew for some reason, or something similar. And he'd watch them come in and feed, but more importantly, when they flew off, he would try as best he could to track them. And, you know, if he could take them 30 yards, then he'd put the Mountain Dew there. And in particular, what it was good for is finding these ground nests under bushes and other places where it's not quite obvious. And by doing that, if you can find the nest, you're taking out 200 or 300 creatures. The problem with the wasp trap is you're taking out 2 or 3 workers that really... Whether they're there or not, it's not going to influence the population. And so this is a tough one. I mean, the wasps now know that there's food there. They get in the habitat. They can literally communicate to other wasps, hey, you know, there's free food down the road, and it's grape jelly, and we all love it, and type of thing. And it's so hard to get them to break the habit. And so, unfortunately, it's you know, as you said, earlier in the year, the wasp had other food, and their numbers were low. But now we're at that point from now for the next 5-6 weeks, as I said, it's going to be a major battle. And it could be 100 yards away. I mean, it does not have to be a nest on your property per se, and that makes it even more difficult.
Yeah, I've tried to watch them leave, and it's just so difficult to see where they go off to. I can't even follow them. And so I guess we're going to have to abandon the jelly, and it's really a shame.
Yeah, no, and it is, you know, we get this with hummingbird feeders too, and although that sometimes there's some designs of hummingbird feeders that make it a little tougher for the wasps to get access, but it is just a common problem, and it doesn't have to be ground nesters. There are some aerial nesting paper wasp and yellow jackets, especially more on the yellow jacket side, that get to be scavengers and are just after that sugar and the grape jelly.
I was thinking back a few couple months ago or so, I had the author of a book on he hunts bees, and the whole strategy, and it was really interesting to see. Of course, he finds them in the woods, you know, the wild nests and that. And he doesn't do anything with them. He just hunts them just to hunt them and find them and note them.
Yeah, well, you know, and it's interesting, again, this one of these things from during my career, you know, when all the problems came with the mites and whatnot, feral colonies of honeybees almost seemed to disappear. But one of the things that's taken off in the last 10 years in particular is people will call about swarms. And these are basically wild bee swarms of honeybees, which suggests that the feral bees are coming back. And you know, people have speculated as, again, we're starting to see them mount some defenses against some of these problems that they've had in the past.
We saw a swarm at a Brewers game and at Miller Park. And unfortunately for that swarm, they were swarming right on the fence right next to...
Yeah, and with all the
bunch of people.
I mean, you can get a beekeeper to come in, and they would love to take the swarm if you can find the beekeeper. But in a situation like that, where you got lots of people and we got to get it taken care of now, that doesn't work.
That wouldn't work. Well, thanks, Jerry, for calling. Appreciate it. Jerry in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Jerry.
Hi there. Hey, thanks for taking my call. Phil, it's always a delight to listen to this program. And, again, I'm sorry, I'm going back to the question of wasps again, but you answered two of my questions with the other Jerry about the traps. We have this problematic nest that after years of sealing off around the sill plate on my house, they found a way in there, and they're like a couple of feet from our knees when we're at the kitchen sink, so they're listening to the grinder and the dishwasher. Well, hopefully that's not agitating them. But is there anything different in treatments to eradicate a nest? I know most of the websites, your Wisconsin website and Minnesota's and Pennsylvania's all say the same thing. Don't mess with the nest. If you seal it up or poison it, they'll find a different way out, which in our case would be either into the kitchen or into the basement. As it is, the few wasp ones that find their way into the basement are attracted to fluorescent light. Mm-hmm. I can suck them off of that with a shop vac, and then close up the shop vac when I'm not down there. And that controls them pretty good. One other related behavioral question after if you have another moment.
Sure. But you know, going back, do you know where the wasps were coming out in this crack, where they're coming and going from?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So the whole secret here to me is... If it's a kind of wasp nest that is visible in front of you, you can see the paper and whatnot, then the aerial things that you buy, the sprays at the hardware store, are the way to go. And we always suggest to troutly treat in the early evening when the wasps are there. And if you treat in the middle of the day, there are workers that are out, and they come back, and they get quite agitated. But we find if you try to spray those things into these cracks, the results are often very poor. Instead, what we usually would suggest, if it is a ground nest or a, you know, something disappearing in a hole, you got to use a dust and not a spray. And how you apply the dust gets a little bit tricky, because a lot of times the dust is like a giant salt shaker, and it's not conducive for blowing it into a hole. But if you use an old squeeze ketchup bottle, or you can buy something called a bulb duster at the hardware store. And so the same thing, you wait to the evening and you dust that entrance that they're coming and going as best you can. Why the dust performs better is when they come and go, they get the dust on their bodies. And so we find it's a much more efficient. Then once you are pretty sure that you've succeeded, which might take a day or two, but often it's much quicker than that, then you can seal that entrance. I don't think hope is lost here, but as I said, you kind of have to mark it, and wait until 7:30, 8 o'clock at night.
Can I put a little cardboard box there or something to put the dust on as a little aircraft landing zone for them?
If they have to land on it, you got to, you know, they're sometimes quite industrious at finding different ways to get there. But
yeah,
as I said, usually, you know, an old squeeze bottle of some sort to blow the dust, or as best you can apply it. So where you see they land, they have to walk through it. And as I said, I would wait. You know, preferably you get a 45-degree morning and you can do it right at sunrise because the cooler temperatures, they wouldn't be active. But
20 years ago, I did that, and I wore all my winter clothes. But a behavioral question. I first realized that they were going in and out of this spot in the wall here because we used fans on the back deck for mosquito control.
Yeah.
And it really works well, just these pedestal fans. And we had two of them out there, and the one they didn't seem to be bothered by, still aren't. But the other one, I don't know if it's because of shorter blades and different pitch of the sound or whatever, but boy, they would attack this fan. And of course, in the process, a number of them would get chopped up and land on the deck. And if I put that out there as a control, would the fact that they're seeing their buddies being chopped up aggravate the nest and change their behavior as a colony?
Probably not. I'm trying to picture it. You know, the first thought is that somehow it's close enough to the nest that they're sensing some kind of danger, much like the lawnmower going by and that vibration getting them all agitated. If that's why they're going to attack.
Well, we use three of these different fans out there, and there's only one of them that elicits this response.
Okay. Well, and it may just be a certain frequency. I don't know if anybody's...
Yeah, audibly it sounds different to you, even to us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but the problem is a numbers game right now. As I said, if the colony is strong, you're dealing with hundreds of individuals, and boy, to rely on that as your only mechanism to reduce the population is getting a little bit. I just don't think it's going to work. And you know, much like the bee traps, I mean, there are some circumstances where you could make the argument that if you put the bee traps out extremely early in the season, when their numbers are low, and you are withdrawing workers at that point, you're putting major stress on the colony because there's so few workers. But once you get into the, quote, bee season or wasp season, I just find that the colonies are way too numerous. And, you know, the few individuals you catch are just not going to make
enough.
That much of a difference.
Yep. There you go, Jerry.
The one thing I learned this year, though, is the shop vac is a wonderful aid in the basement. That fluorescent light attracts them, and they're easy target for a long walk. Wand on the end of the shop
bag. Well, there are some companies that will bring in big vacuum cleaners and stuff, and it just kind of depends to me if the nest is close enough to suck them all out. But
I'm tempted to put the shop bag up in and tape it into that opening of that nest during the night.
Yeah, but the one problem you got is in the housing part of it. Is, you know, if there's a bunch of dust and other things, that will probably do them in. But I have seen cases where I'll get the call that now we got a shop vac full of very angry yellow jackets, and what do we do? And now I've got a problem because I can't get anything to them. And
hey, shop vacs are $20.
There you go.
Duct tape and pray to God that they bury it fast enough. That could work.
Yes.
There you go. Thanks a lot. Good luck, Jerry. Appreciate your call. Mary in North Lake has something for us. Hi, Mary.
Hello, Larry and Phil. I have a bee identification question. It's a big bee, and it's got a black backside, all black, and a little bit of yellow near the head. Do you have any idea what kind of bumblebee that might be?
You sure it's a bumblebee?
Well, no.
Okay. From your description,
but it's round. It's a roundish bee, like a bumblebee.
Yeah. I mean, the when people would call me and talk about a rather large, almost all black, and has a little bit of a whitish yellow on the face and maybe a little bit of whitish yellow on the tip, that typically turns out to be bald-faced hornet.
No, I know what those are. That's not what this is. It's big like a bumblebee.
Okay.
And that it's, you know, the back end is round, but it's all black.
Okay. Then I'll throw another one at you.
Okay.
So one of the things that has become more commonplace in the state in the last 10 years because of the milder winters are carpenter bees. And they look almost identical to bumblebees. But the one thing that you could tell them if you get one to slow down enough is that bumblebees have a fuzzy abdomen, whereas carpenter bees have a shiny abdomen. Because they don't have all those little hairs on it. So it's very similar. Now, they also go out and collect pollen, but where carpenter bees get their name is they will drill tubes into soft wood. And, of course, if that happens to be your siding or your soffits, then they cause problems. We get them in fences and the like. And, you know, early in my career, they were rare, might be the best way of putting it. But especially mm-hmm. in the southeast part of the state now, they seem to be relatively getting well-established. And I just equate it to the lack of cold weather and, you know, kind of a climate change issue that they're extending their range northward. So that would be my second guess.
Okay. Could I have one more question?
Sure.
It's about chiggers, and I think that's also related to the hot, humid weather. But, boy, I got some bites that were just fierce. Just in a flower bed, not in my woods or prairie or anything, and they were fierce. Now, are they seasonal? I mean, I know they're seasonal, but do they come along if we have mostly a hot, humid summer like this?
Well, you know, the chiggers are a mite that are parasitic on insects, and so I find, you know, even though they are more commonplace in states south of us where we often consider things hotter and drier,
right. mm-hmm.
It's a little hard to pick. I mean, I typically don't see people getting them in a lawn because lawn is kind of a desert to everything when you think
yeah.
about it. But when you start to get into lusher areas, so, you know, a common place for people to pick up chiggers is in raspberry patches.
Okay.
And, you know, I think you've got some good moisture levels, you know, lots of habitat for all kinds of insects, including down in the mulch, and then these mites are taking advantage of it. And, you know, the tough thing about chiggers is that they are often burrowed in and gone before you start having the reactions. And so people
yeah.
are often, you know, thinking there's something in there that's irritating, but it's all the things that they left behind that's causing the weeping. And, you know, classic chiggers is often places where the clothing is confined. So on your sock line, on your belt line, are you know, and to me, the wounds often weep. Yeah. It seems
what I had. Or
yeah.
Yeah.
And it can take 2 and 3 weeks to settle down for people. But so, you know, one of the thoughts is when you get, if you know, get a garden in that area again, I'd come out and take a real brisk shower and just really do a good job of toweling off so that you're physically removing any of those little critters. And they are very small. But if you know an area where you got a problem, I would be just a little careful because, you know, you may go and not see them next time, but I think there's a moderate chance there still would be some in that given area.
There you go. Good luck. Thanks, Mary. Ann in Green Bay, we turn to you. Hi, Ann.
Good morning. So I've been seeing all these signs all over the place that say mosquito squad. They spray, obviously, for mosquitoes, rid your yard of mosquitoes. But I'm just wondering, is that toxin chemical that they're using specific to mosquitoes, or is that going to also kill the butterflies and the bees and everything else that's good for a person's yard?
It depends on their selection. In general, all the materials have side impacts and non-target effects. The difference is some of the products they use are short residual, so it's kind of like, you know, the quick fogs or whatnot, kind of clean out what's there, and really those products don't have near as much impact on non-targets. Where things get a little bit more dicey is there are some strategies where they use basically a product that will last for 2 to 3 weeks on anything that they spray. And the bottom line there is most of the things that land on that will be affected. And so you're killing a whole lot of things. And, you know, what I often would suggest, so, you know, you're going to have a family wedding. You know, it's important we don't have mosquitoes in the backyard. Is it reasonable to spray something like that a day or two before people show up so that we have less mosquitoes? I think that is a reasonable concern. But when you start using that multiple times in a season, we literally can see you cause such an upset in the balance. You start making problems with mites and other things that you wouldn't have if you spray. So it's kind of a, you know, cost-benefit type of thing. And as I said, given a special occasion, is it reasonable to use something that has some residual? Yeah, I think maybe. But in the long term, that's not a good strategy because, right. as I said, it really is. In fact, that really was not the intent of some of these sprays. But they have a 2 to 3 week residual on foliage, and that's where you find you get the mosquitoes, but as you say, all kinds of other things that come into contact with it.
And there we go. Thanks, Ann, for that call. Appreciate it. Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at the world of insects today with Phil Pelletieri, a retired UW entomologist. Great to have him with us today. Join in at 800-642-1234. Also, you can post a photo on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. That's the title of the page. We have a lot of good photos up there. We'll talk about them in just a second. I know you're going to want to see some of them. First, let's go, though, to Annie in La Crosse. Annie, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. We are inundated with fruit flies, and they seem to be hanging around my sink more than anything, and I keep the drain cleaned out, but there might be stuff way down in there. So what kind of a trap can I build, or what is the best way to eradicate these little buggers?
Okay, well, it's really more being a good detective than anything, because you're seeing the adult fruit flies. They're probably attracted to the various odors. As you know, you have something, a little vinegar or some wine out, and they kind of come out of nowhere. They're attracted many times to those kind of yeasty fermenting things. And so some people have used that to their advantage. They'll use a little vinegar fly trap, something with kind of a funnel, so the flies fly in but have a hard time getting out. But if you're really trying to solve it, you have to find out what kind of material they're finding and utilizing to breed in, where they've got their little maggots and the like. And it's usually, well, it's always stuff that is extremely overripe and fermenting. And the reason for this is that the maggots feed on the yeast associated with the decay and fermenting. So that's the whole secret of fruit flies, is yeast. And that's why they're attracted to bread and other things, because they smell that yeast. And even though the bread is too dry for them to lay their eggs and breed in it, they will be drawn to it. So you have to start looking at the bottom of garbage cans if things are caked. You have to be careful when you recycle cans that you rinse them sufficiently. So, and I've told the story a number of times on the show. Back when my kids were little, my wife used to give them sugared Kool-Aid once a year. And my daughter had a little cup of Kool-Aid that was down in the basement, and she left it there, and so it kind of all dried up and got syrupy. I bet you we bred 35 fruit flies out of that, just in, of course, it's got sugar as a base. It's got yeast that's helping break down that sugar,
sure.
And the fruit flies found it, and they were happy as heck. So it's trying to hunt these things down. And, you know, it could be something as innocent as a mop that you use to clean up some you know, spilled orange juice. But if you didn't rinse it out, that kind of slimy goop that's on that mop is sufficient enough to breed fruit flies. So.
Yeah.
There you go. Good luck with that. Appreciate your call. Let's turn to some of the photos on our Facebook page. Here's one from Carol. This is pretty interesting. She says, I found this intricate tunnel near my front door. What can you tell me about
the mud daubers?
Mud daubers.
So they're out of the thread-waisted wasp group, and most of the mud daubers we have here are predators on spiders. So they go out and catch spiders, paralyze them. They construct this little tube. They put the spiders in there, lay their egg, and then their larvae are on their own. And so this is what we call a solitary wasp. This is not technically a nest when you think of like a honeybee or a yellow jacket where you've got a queen and all these workers. For that reason, we find that they're really very docile. They really don't have this defense mechanism for it. And so you know, if you don't like spiders, you know, you can thank the mud daubers for grossly reducing their numbers. And once the nest is left, or this breeding tube, if you want to think of it that way, you know, it'll stay there. I mean, it really weathers extremely well. And they do have to go out and collect mud and bring it back and pack it in. And there's other species that make other kinds of tubes and pots and chambers. It's really quite interesting when you get into these. And many of them are small enough that people, I think, probably overlook it. But when they put it on the siding of your house, it catches your attention.
Here's another one from Kathy. She says, I think this is a mayfly. It landed on a mirror. It's a really pretty picture.
Yeah.
At the Stockton, Wisconsin art show recently.
Well, you know, if anybody gets lucky enough to see the major mayfly emergences, it's like a science fiction movie. I mean, it really is a treat. You know, they only last for a few days at best, and you know, you see it one year in a spot, and you can go back to that spot for the next 5 years during the same time frame and not see it. So it's not as predictable as some people might think. But you know, very fascinating, because they're so short lived. As adults, we're talking, you know, a day or two at best. They don't feed, but they have these mass emergences, which, of course, helps them in their mating in the continuation of the species.
And then we've got a photo, several photos. Here's one from Matt.
This is the time of the year, if you like big butterflies, the swallowtails in particular. So Matt has a tiger swallowtail, which is one of the three common species that we have here. We have a couple other ones that you can run into. It's interesting because the tiger swallowtail has two forms. In the females in particular, in the late summer, they have this yellow and black form. But I know we have a picture farther down here.
Yeah.
This is the black form of the
From
tiger
Patty.
Swallowtail.
Yeah, oh, that's beautiful, isn't
and
it?
And there is also a black swallowtail. That we have that looks somewhat similar. If you're used to looking at the butterflies, you can tell them apart. Maybe good to recommend, there is an exquisite site called the Butterflies of Wisconsin. Mike Reese has put together. And if you want to identify butterflies that you see here, you go to Mike's site and he'll show you when they fly, where they fly, how to distinguish the various species. And it's all Wisconsin species. And as I said, Mike has done a fantastic job over the years of putting it in most of the pictures that Mike has, he's taken himself in state. So that even adds to me more to the site. And Mike has got other things on robber flies. As I said, he does some great photography work. And some of the critters he's got pictures of are not very easy to get. So I very much admire his skill.
Well, Tom sent a photo. I'm not sure how to describe it. It's a little fuzzy.
It's a caterpillar that we call a dagger moth. It's from the dagger moth group. There's more than one species. And the way I can tell it is because of these black pencil hairs, which some people would mistake for antennae, but those are just bristly hairs that come off from the body.
And the rest of it's kind of white.
Right. And furry. You know, it reminds people of a woolly bear. But yeah. The woolly bear does not have those pencil hairs. Another moth family that are often fuzzy with these pencil hairs are the various tussock moths. So there's three or four different ones that we can run into in the state that kind of look like woolly bears, but not quite. And as I said, those pencil hairs are the way to tell them apart.
Well, let's go to Ellen in Waupun next. Ellen, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. We have a picnic coming up in a week or so at a park in an outdoor shelter, and I'm concerned about bees at that picnic. Would it be helpful to spray in that area earlier in the day to fend off some of these?
Not much. I, you know what? My bigger concern would be is the trash cans and containers there. And because, again, you know, those things are not, you know, they're dump, but you often get spillage of pop and stuff. And so these wasps are used to coming in. And so, you know, the first thing I would do is, if there's any trash cans, is move them as far away from the shelter and still make it practical as you can.
Okay.
And then, as I said, if there's any kind of spillage before you get there, make sure that that's cleaned up. And then try to keep the food, as much as reasonable, confined, you know, so that there's not open food containers except when people are eating, and then get things cleaned up and moved out of there as quick as possible. And I think that has a bigger impact. The problem with sprays is they really don't land anywhere in a regular enough basis for the sprays to, you know, flies always seem to land in certain areas, and so they sometimes use residuals. The wasps don't land as much. They're just kind of, they're jumping on the food and flying away with it. So as I said, basically management of potential food sources to me is the most important.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for calling, Ellen. Tammy in Onalaska, hello.
Hello. I am a beekeeper, and I set up a new yard 2 years ago in a prairie area down next to Mississippi. But there's a lot of farmland and corn around it. But downwind is about 160 acres of Mississippi Wildlife Refuge prairie. I'm wondering, but my bees aren't producing well this year, and I don't know why. I know a lot of things got, a lot of blossoms got frozen and stuff this spring. But I'm just wondering if bees, how they figure out where their food and pollen nectar source is, and if being downwind makes a difference, or upwind, as it were.
Well, you know, they tend to forage in all directions, and if they find a good food reservoir, a nectar source, they have ways of communicating to their fellow workers. And so they're pretty good at picking up on things if the resource is there. You know, and of course, different years, you know, in beekeeping is not my expertise, but, you know, in general, sometimes the hotter, drier years, which tend to produce more flowers, tend to be better for honey production. And sometimes the lush green years, it seems the plants put a whole lot of energy in growing leaves and not as much in flowering. And that tends to be so, you know, that's, take it for what it is, but you do find seasonal effects sometimes that don't appear to be obvious, but it does relate to how much food resources are available. And of course, a cornfield is, you know, bees do to a very minor extent use corn pollen, but that's really not the stuff that they're going to thrive and do well on. So,
no, I understood they have about a 3-mile radius, and the wildlife refuge is within 3/4 of a mile or to a mile of you know,
yeah,
from one of the hives are, so that should be okay.
Yeah, you would think, and again, you know, it used to be at a time we had a little bit of concern. There were some insect problems in the mid to late summer. You could get in cornfields, and they would be spraying the cornfields, and that was not good for the bees. But most of the corn now is designed and modified so it's not susceptible to some of those insects, and because of that, honestly, it's made it easier to keep bees in association to corn. Now, there are some concerns about when corn is planted, and some of the things that are used as seed treaters can cause bees problems if these things, the talc gets infected and the like. But generally speaking, as I said, once you get past that planting time, corn is really not much of a problem as far as causing problems with the bees.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Vic emailed to say he has a great crop of milkweed, and he's seeing orange and black beetles about 3/4 of an inch long, more than any caterpillars. He's not seeing. Are they harmful to monarchs?
Well, there's two critters that you can run into. There is two species of longhorn beetles that are basically almost reddish with black dots, great big long antennae, about an inch long. But if you're getting clusters of things, the milkweed seed bug is something you will see now, and those are orange and black. And if you're not used to looking at them, they have a sucking mouth part, where beetles have a chewing mouth part, and they're not quite as hard, but that might be. But they are seed feeders, and so you know, they do affect the seed production of a milkweed plant, but they really don't pose any threat to the monarchs at all because they're utilizing a totally different thing. The monarchs or caterpillars are utilizing the leaves as a food source. So.
And Carol wondered if it's okay to put monarch caterpillars in a safe place with milkweed, or should she just let nature take its course?
Well, you know, you have a higher success rate if you do some babysitting and the like. And, you know, we had talked this morning about Joe had shared with us the project they've got with milkweed, but there are places now, and I know in Iowa, where they will give you eggs, you raise your milkweed, and you raise the monarchs in a protected cage.
Ah, there we go. We can talk some more about that. We'll take a quick look at the news, and then we'll be back with Phil. We're taking a look at the world of insects today. Larry Mueller here, my guest Phil Pelletieri. Phil comes by every couple months or so to talk with us, retired entomologist with UW Extension, headed the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab for many years, and it's always great to have him come by. You may have a question about a bug or an insect in your neighborhood. I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Getting lots of nice photos on our Facebook page. Go to listener posts, and you'll see a lot of them. Phil, we were talking about monarchs kind of protecting them.
So, you know, you tend to find when they get about half-grown, because of predation and parasites and all kinds of other things, there's really very high natural mortality. So I think people will find that they have a higher success rate if they take the half-grown caterpillars, bring them into the house, and then, you know, feed them new milkweed leaves every couple days and kind of rear them in a more protected environment. So that, and it's fun. If you got young kids, they can observe what's going on. You know, another common trait is when the caterpillars are done, they will crawl away. You know, people are hoping to see the chrysalis on their milkweed patch. Well, the caterpillars, and this we think is a bit of a defense mechanism they have of crawling away, because when they're in the chrysalis stage, they're a sitting duck when you think about it. So, as I said, I think that's a reasonable thing. Now, the little tiny caterpillars are a little harder to keep track of, so I often wait, as I said, till they're about half grown, and then if I'm lucky enough to have some on our butterfly weed or whatnot, then we will bring it and raise it in a little cage until we get the adult butterflies off.
Laurel in Sturgeon Bay has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Laurel.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I am calling because we have a birch tree right outside of our garage door, and about 10 feet up in the birch is a beautiful paper wasp nest that's huge. And I'm wondering, we'd love to leave it there because it's interesting, and we love it. The wasps have not been bothering us, but I'm wondering if I'm being irresponsible. We have house guests this weekend, and I'm worried irresponsible?
I think it's just fine. It's high enough that, you know, you worry when it's low enough that it's going to bump into some, you know, people are going to bump into it or pets are going to bump into it, because that's when they get defensive. And this sounds high enough. So, you know, anything above 10 feet, you know, people are climbing their big maple trees to get a nest out. I mean, that's the threat to them. And
yeah.
So you should be fine. It's going to be, you know, and you may want to wait until, probably at least the 15th of October to the 1st of November. And then you can, if you want to, go up and cut it out. They will be dead. They basically starve to death. You know, you can keep that if you would like. And yeah, it sounds as long as it's not in a place that you worry about people dumping into it or, you know, the neighbor kids throwing rocks at it, that kind of thing, that's not a good idea. But other than that, you should be just fine.
Oh, awesome. Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks so much for calling. Chip and Baraboo, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi there. I'm looking for identification on a bright green angular beetle.
Where do you see it? Is it just one or is it a whole bunch together?
Just one. It's never in a tree. It's like on a sidewalk or...
Okay, and are they really fast? I mean, if you bother them, they kind of take off and fly, you know, 20 feet?
They are very fast, yeah.
Okay. I think it's one of the tiger beetles. And tiger beetles are predators, are related to our ground beetles, and they are extremely brilliant green or copper, depending on the species. Again, I had talked about the site on Wisconsin butterflies that Mike Reese has got. Well, it turns out Mike also has a part of his website dedicated to Wisconsin tiger beetles. So you can go there, look there for the various species, and again, they'll give you an idea of the range and the like. And when I was mentioning before how much I admire Mike, can you imagine how difficult it is to get a close-up of an insect that is that nervous as a tiger beetle? But yet I think Mike has a picture of all but one or two of the native tiger beetles in Wisconsin. And so, as I said, he spent a lot of time. But they often are in open areas, paths and the like. You'll see them sitting there waiting for prey to come by. And if you get up close to them, you see these tremendous-looking jaws, which they use to catch caterpillars and slugs and other kinds of creatures. So.
There we
I'll
go.
I'll never get that close to him.
All right. Thanks a lot, Chip. Appreciate the call. Oh, boy. Diane in New Berlin, your turn. Hi, Diane.
Hi. How are you?
Great. Appreciate the call.
Good. Hey, we have fun propagating butterflies in the past. I've raised monarchs and just, you know, accidentally brought in a swallow-tailed caterpillar on my dill last weekend when I was making pickles. So he's happily munching away. But one creature that I often see in my tomato patch are the great big tomato caterpillars.
Yeah,
great big cornworm. Usually I pick them up and I feed them to the chickens. But I know they make a really massive moss. Mm-hmm. Is it possible for me to propagate that as well?
Yes, but it's going to be a little different because what happens when they're done eating is the larvae will burrow into the ground. And they don't make a cocoon. They make a pupal case that is dark chestnutty brown and about as big as your thumb. Mm-hmm. And that's how they spend the winter.
Ah.
So you have to give them a place to burrow into. And you also have to make sure that they are in a place that is chilled because they need to be conditioned. So what I'm saying is if you brought that into your basement and kept it warm all winter, you think you're doing the favor and they probably won't develop properly. But if you put it in the garage, let it go through a chilling and then warming up, you will get an adult hawk moth out sometime in May, early June, depending on the temperatures get exposed to. So, yeah, it's well worth it. And if you look at the caterpillars very carefully, they start to lose a bit of their color when they're getting prepared to go in the ground. So it's almost like they give you a little bit of a warning. But I just use some loose soil. You could probably even do it in something like vermiculite. But as I said, if you just got some loose soil and allow them to burrow, that's a good sign when they disappear in the container because that means they burrowed in and they've pupated. And then, as I said, go through the chilling process. So it'll take a few months, but hopefully you'll be rewarded.
Oh, that's awesome. How deep of a bedding do I need to give them?
I would probably give them something in the neighborhood of 3 to 4 inches, if possible.
Okay, yeah. Cool.
All right.
Sounds like fun.
Yeah, it does sound like fun. Shoot us a photo now when that one hatches.
All right, great.
All right, thanks, Diane. Oh, boy. Lisa in Lake Geneva, your turn. Hi, Lisa.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I have dahlias that I'm dinner plate ones that I'm growing in a greenhouse. This is my first year ever with this greenhouse. And they're getting those mealy bugs, white mealy bugs, and they're killing my plants and it's infested. I've tried neem oil and sprayed it like quite regularly and it isn't killing the mealy bugs.
Okay. I would consider getting insecticidal soap. There's a product that they sell and it's a soap and neem oil is kind of interesting because it can kill them in many different ways, but it's not as predictable, whereas the soap, I know, will kill them as a contact. But what is as important is you have to be on about a 10-day schedule, and you have to treat, come back 10 days later, come back 10 days later, and do that for a total of at least 3 treatments to totally wipe them out. And the reason is that the adult mealybugs and the eggs are not near as susceptible to the soaps. So what you're doing is breeding or bleeding out the immatures. If you miss treatments, you got to start from scratch. Huh. But that is one way. There are other products you can use that have a little more residual. But if you're, again, looking for something that's kind of organic and easy to handle, I have more faith in the soaps. And we've had good luck with it on mealybug control.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Back up to our Facebook page, Mamie sent us a photo. We saw this wasp-looking bug lay what we think was an egg on this bench. After it was finished, it looked very weak.
Okay, so the beast is called, as a common name, a horntail. And it is not a stinging wasp, but it is a creature that is parasitic on wood-boring insects in particular. And so you often will see horntails is on the stump of a maple tree that is in some kind of decline. And what they've got are insects feeding in the dead wood, and these are going after that. Big creature. I mean, with the tail, they're upwards of maybe an inch and a half or so.
Yeah.
So impressive, scary looking, but absolutely harmless to people. And as I said, usually if you see them hovering around a tree or a branch, it's because there is dead wood and wood borers in there, and this is a parasite of those wood borers.
Fred and Racine, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hello. Great show, Larry and Phil. It started in the garage a few years ago. I was raising these little bigger than a house fly, the more aggressive flies. And unfortunately, now I get them in the house, and it seems like late July, they're all over the house, well, mainly in the kitchen and such, but I put up that sticky paper tape and get some of them there, but I'm swatting and trying to get rid of them, so I guess they're nesting in the house now. Is that possible?
Well, no, because typically, you know, the first problem is there's a whole bunch of things that look like house flies that are not. And so the first thing I would suggest, it's worth catching some of those and bring them in the extension office or sending them to the diagnostic lab. And PJ can take a look just to verify who it is, because what that will point us to is what the food source is. And why I think it's not, I mean, if you've got a garbage can you forget about and to take out and it's got protein and stuff in it, you can breed a whole lot of flies, whether they're blowflies or house flies, in a very short period of time. But once that food source is taken, gone, they're done. And so there's not normally a sustainable food source for true house flies in some of the other what we call filth flies. Now, the other problem, though, is that there are some flies that have nothing to do with garbage that will show up in your house. Sometimes those are associated with livestock situations. Other times, you know, the common one we will be getting into relatively shortly are the cluster flies that look very much like house flies, but they are an earthworm parasite during the summer. But they have a behavior of migrating into protected sites in the late summer and fall. And then all winter long, people are bothered with these, quote, house flies. But it has nothing to do, and they're not breeding. That's the important point, is they're not breeding, but they are looking for sheltered places to spend the winter. And it almost sounds more like one of those kind of situations for you, because it's sustaining itself. And as I said, I can't believe that you have the food resources for flies to be breeding in your house on a regular basis. That just is not normal.
They last for about a week or two, and then they kind of are gone. They still get a few around, but not like the when they start.
Okay, now typically when I would get that call, you know, this explosion and whatnot, then it typically is something like a flesh fly or a blow fly, where let's say a bird died up in the attic space, and I can breed a whole lot of flies off a bird, but that's a once occurrence type of thing, and then it's done. It should not reoccur. I mean, that part of it sounds very much like that kind of scenario. And if it's a small food source, you don't smell it. If it was something big like a raccoon, to be honest, your nose would tell you you've got a problem more than just the fly problem. So.
But it does seem to occur annually. So.
Yeah, see, and that's that odd thing of an animal dying. It shouldn't be that predictable. And as I said, so I think it's worth, dead flies are fine, but just get them accurately identified, just so we know what direction to look to, where the source is coming from, and then you deal with that. You know,
the greenback fly, is that enough to tell you what it is?
Well, that suggests a blowfly. And blowflies will feed on high protein, and it can be dead animals, but it can be garbage. Blowflies, interesting enough, are more of a cool season fly, so it's kind of a spring problem and a late summer problem. Oh. They don't like it real hot.
Oh.
But then I would again ask, what would you have around that is high enough protein? It has to have moisture. They don't do well on dry stuff, so it's got to be wet. That would allow them. Now, I can breed them in about 10 days if you give me the right circumstance. But why would it be an annual reoccurrence? As I said, that's something that you would have to look at. In the normal house, you just don't expect it.
Okay, so those paper sticky strips are about the only thing I got now.
Yeah, I mean, what it does is it gets the adult flies that are flying around, but what you always try to point people to is finding the food source, eliminate that, because that's where they're breeding. If you don't find the food source, it's a little bit of shooting in the dark, really.
Yeah, there you go. Good luck, Fred. Thank you. Dan in Madison, your turn. Hi, Dan.
Hi, thank you. A hero of all of us. I got four questions, but if I'm succinct, we can do it. A bumblebee, is it ever called a yellow jacket because that darn yellow jacket on a bumblebee is so adorable?
No, that's an interesting observation, but, you know, a yellow jacket refers to a group of wasps. In a bumblebee, of course, most of our bumblebees are black and yellow, although we do have some that do have some reddish fur on them, too, depending on the species.
All my life I wanted to call them yellow jacket. Nobody let me. Okay, yellow jackets. While I'm a green guy, I have a hard time with them. How can I love them? What do they do for us all?
Well, again, they are predators on various insects. That's their main protein source, especially. So they do feed on a bunch of pest species, but they'll also feed on a monarch caterpillar. So, I mean, you kind of said they're kind of generalist. So it's relative to what they're eating if we consider them good guys or not.
Okay. I'm going to skip this one. Male mosquitoes, how many females do they impregnate before they die?
Good question. I'm thinking
in your mind from the Zika talk.
Yeah, I would think that the sex ratio is 50-50, so you think one or two at best. You know, interesting enough, we can tell from female mosquitoes if they're dissected that there are some that are capable of going through three or four reproductive cycles. So that means they fed, laid a batch of eggs, go find somebody else to feed on. And that's very important biologically because of the transmission of diseases. I mean, mosquitoes, generally speaking, start their life out clean. They have to feed on somebody that's infected with malaria or Zika or whatnot, and then they become infected for life.
I would have gambled that they only get one blood meal and lay eggs and go.
No.
Okay, difference between yellow jackets and paper wasps, just different species of vespid?
Well, to be honest, there are species that technically could be called both a paper wasp or yellow jacket. The Polistes genus, which is the ones that make those paper nests that you can see all the little chambers in, would not be technically called yellow jackets, but the ones that make the envelope paper wasp nest are all considered yellow jackets, whether it's the eastern yellow jacket, the western yellow jacket, the German yellow jacket. As I said, there are a number of species that we do have in the state.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, Dan.
Thanks so much.
Yeah. Appreciate the call. Mary in Middleton, thank you for calling.
Oh, yes. Is this Phil I'm talking to?
Yes.
Hi, Mary.
Hi.
I recognize the voice.
Mary, be good. Your old student, entomology student from years back.
Yes.
Hi, Phil. I want to ask you, a friend of mine asked me about a tiny flying sucking insect attacking his cherry tomatoes, size of mosquitoes, inflicting a myriad of tiny scars where they sucked, disfiguring the fruit. I wasn't familiar with it, but I told them I certainly know who would.
Mm-hmm.
Diagnose and remedy, please, Phil.
So, you know, what that sounds like is one of the true bugs. And, you know, some of those, as you know, are predators, but some of them are plant feeders. And although I don't think it's in the plant bug family, I have seen some myriads, they're little stilt bugs is what I'm thinking of. But they suck the juices out, but they leave this little ghosty white spot where they're feeding. They would respond quite well to insecticidal soap. They're a soft-bodied insect. It's not an overly common problem, but I have seen it, and I have seen it even in greenhouses. So, you know, it definitely fits the description. So I would think just one insecticidal soap spray should knock the population down enough that he should be able to get blemish-free fruit from now on. So,
good. I guess I got lucky. I told him to give it a dose of insecticidal soap until I could talk to you.
Yeah, no, I mean, that works. You know, where the soap gets us in trouble is hard-bodied insects. It doesn't perform as well, but this would be considered a soft-bodied insect. And
definitely, yeah. Yes.
All right.
Good. Good to hear from you.
Thank you, Phil.
Thanks, Mary. Thank you for calling. We have Larry in Rice Lake next. Hi, Larry.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Phil. I have a question today. I have a problem with mud wasps, at least that's what I call them. I have mud wasps every summer. They come into my garage and my workshop. They deposit their mud into any little orifice they can find, such as electrical outlets, the third prong. They'll pack those tight. They went into 20-pound LP cylinders that I did not have the little safety plug in and packed that tight. Didn't find out till I hooked it up to the grill and then had a disaster with the regulator. They'll go into a power drill that's hanging on the wall where there's a screw where they assemble the drill, and they'll pack that full. It's every year I find all these treasures. I catch them in the act quite often, and I live near water, near a swampy lake. I have a brother that lives about 4 miles as the crow flies. He never, ever has them. He also lives out in the country, but doesn't live near water. I don't know what to do to prevent them. They're not really hurting anybody other than irritating me. You know, and I have my doors open quite a bit when I'm home. I'm in and out. So, you know, if I have the door shut, then they can't go in and out. Yeah. So I'm sure I'm not the only one with the problem, but hoping you can give me some ideas on keeping them things away.
Boy, it's not easy. Now, I'm going to take kind of out-of-the-box thoughts here, you know, because at first what I'd preach is to keep things closed. Okay, that's not going to work. What you might consider is setting up a fan that will blow a reasonable force of air so that they, you know, they have a hard time flying in. I honestly wonder if that may discourage them as much as anything else. You know, the problem is, you know, if there were orifices you knew about that you could seal, so you're basically getting rid of what they're looking for, that would help. But you can't do that for tools and those kind of odd things that they're messing with. I'm also a little bit curious because, you know, although there is the classic mud dauber wasp, I do know of other species of wasp and bees that utilize mud in straw-like environments, and that's kind of sounding what they're trying to exploit. But as I said, I go back to thinking of just some physical way, because I don't think this is going to be solved with a spray type of thing, of wondering if you can set up an oscillating fan that will, you know, because we use this trick in food handling establishments and whatnot to keep flies out, so that when the door opens, there's enough of an air coming against them that the flies can't get in. And as I said, that it's a bit of a wild thought, but I wonder if that may be worth trying just to see if you can discourage them from getting access.
Yeah, you know, the door, the big door is pretty large, and then I have the entrance door as well, and you probably already know this, but so when I dig out a packed area, which I've done, at the very bottom of this orifice, there's often a little grub, like a little white worm that we ice fish with.
Right, Yeah. So the one thing, when you're digging in there, do you also find little, you say, I'm expecting there to be insect prey, or you find pollen? Either or of those in those little straws or tubes?
The only thing I've ever discovered was mud and a little larvae.
All right.
Okay, so that you would think you'd find spider bodies if it was the true mud dauber, whereas I said, you're probably getting into this a little bit late and they've exhausted the food source, but I'm just suspicious it's one of the other species, but it's the same type of thing. They're outside creatures taking advantage of the nice environment you've got for them to breed, and they're looking for those little cracks and crevices and the like. So,
Larry, thank you so much. And Phil, thank you so much. You'll come back, be with us again.
A couple months.
All right, great. Phil Pelletieri, a retired UW Extension entomologist. He'll be back in a couple of months, and we'll talk with him again. Thanks for listening. Please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network.